This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Greetings and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm your host, Monica Black. As you know, at New Books in History, we scour the globe for exciting new history books the world needs to know about, and we interview their authors. And today I have the pleasure of speaking with Benjamin Bryce. Benjamin Bryce has written A History of Belonging. It's called To Belong in Buenos Aires, Germans, Argentines, and the Rise of a Pluralist Society. It was published very recently, this year, in fact, by Stanford University Press. And I first saw it in Stanford University Press's catalog. So if Stanford University Press is wondering whether anyone looks at their catalog, I can assure them that that is the case. The book describes a period from the 1880s to the 1930s when a massive wave of immigration transformed Argentine society and the country's cultural landscape. Benjamin Bryce describes how, alongside the leaders of many immigrant enclaves in Buenos Aires, Germans too created ethnic spaces in an effort to maintain the pluralism, Benjamin Bryce says, that their own migration had given rise to. German immigrants built institutions to do that, many different kinds, from orphanages to hospitals to schools, and they became loyal Argentine citizens, even as they maintained a connection to German culture. But even as German Argentines strove to maintain their own sense of particularity, their Spanish-speaking spouses and children sometimes opposed them, as did German socialists, German-speaking Catholics, and, as Benjamin Bryce puts it, many others who all struck their own balance between community and the broader Argentine world they had joined. Benjamin Bryce's book fits into the burgeoning field of migration history, and there have been a number of really terrific books recently that have dealt specifically with German migration. It's an important and a timely topic, of course. Migration is generating tremendous political energy throughout today's world, certainly in the Americas and in today's Germany too. So Benjamin Bryce, or I'll call you Ben. Ben, thanks so much for agreeing to appear on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's a delight. And I really appreciated and enjoyed reading your book very much. I think I told you that in addition to being a German historian, I'm also very much interested in the history of Latin America and Argentina in particular. So this was a real treat for me. I wonder if we could start, please, by asking you to talk about your biography, whether your sort of scholarly background or any sort of details you'd like to fill in for listeners, particularly perhaps the question of how you came to this project.
I'm an assistant professor at the University of Northern British Columbia. That's in central British Columbia, about 800 kilometers north of Vancouver. I've been there for 4 years now, and I did my PhD, finished 5 years ago at York University in Toronto. I came to this project through a sort of a combination of personal experiences and then some graduate school shaping, I would say. When I was 17, I spent a year in Argentina on a Rotary exchange, and that was my first contact with Argentina, my first contact with Latin America. Actually, it was the first country outside of Canada, the United States, that I'd visited. And that got me interested right from the beginning. I was already interested in history from high school, and sort of got increasingly interested in Argentine history. So when I then started my undergraduate degree at the University of British Columbia, I took Latin American history, Latin American studies, and German history as a side note, and sort of just got interested in learning more about Argentine history. And then for a series of paths that life takes, I ended up moving to Germany right after my undergraduate degree, like 5 days after I finished classes or finished final exams, and spent a summer first in Schleswig-Holstein right on the Danish border, and then moved to Berlin for the next 11 months. So I spent about 15 months in Germany, became quite interested in Germany, having already learned Spanish, learned about learning languages in Argentina. I did well with German, and then sort of thought, how can I merge these two personal interests and also then my personal or an intellectual interest in the histories of these two places. And as you've said, and I think we all notice, migration, multiculturalism are things that are really pertinent in today's society, or at the time in 2006 society, when I was starting graduate school. And I thought of how I can have a graduate project that would sort of connect these two interests. So I decided to do an MA thesis, starting with an MA thesis. In Canada, there was separate degrees. You'd apply for an MA, and that could be the end of it after the MA, terminal MAs. I decided to come up with, so the project I proposed and ended up writing was a focus on a comparison of German identity in both Argentina and Canada, focusing on Buenos Aires and Ontario, so the two largest parts of these two countries that both have a long history of migration. And there was already, I was connecting also to another historiography of comparing Argentine and Canadian development or changes in this time period, 1880s to 1930s. There'd been other comparative books written about wheat and things like that. And migration came up as a part of a broader economic history of these very similar paths of, if you sort of look at data, kilometers of railroads, wheat production, wheat exports, population numbers, there's all these sort of demographic, economic things that kind of unite the two countries in ways. If you compare to anywhere else in the Americas, these two countries on the north and south, southern ends of the continent that have a lot in common. And immigration came up, but just sort of as a factor, not a study of cultures of immigration, not a social history of immigration. And so that seemed like a void. That's got me into the project. It gave me another reason to go back to Germany. So in the second year of my MA, I actually did a graduate exchange from York University to the Freie Universität and worked on my MA thesis in Germany, but for my Canadian degree, and ended up writing this a narrow focus on comparing two German language newspapers from Canada and Argentina. And then that brought me to the PhD. So that's the background that got me interested in this topic. It's been a fun ride.
It's a very interesting story that you just told. And in fact, even though you and I have never met in person, we seem to have many overlapping interests and maybe even strange common life experiences. One of which is that I too have lived in Schleswig-Holstein and very near the Danish border in a little place called Lech Klintum. Do you know where that is?
I don't think so. I probably have driven through it, but it doesn't ring a bell. I lived in Nibruel, the last train stop before going to Zult. That's where I lived.
Yes, I attended the...
In a town of 8,000. How big was your town?
No, much smaller than Nibruel. I attended the gymnasium for 1 year in Nibruel, and Lech Klintum was a little...
Into the Friedrich Paulsen Schule?
Sorry?
The Friedrich Paulsen Schule? I worked, that's what brought me to that town, your high school. I worked there as a language assistant for 4 months. That was my first time living in Germany. So we've been to the same school.
That is amazing. That's quite a coincidence. Well, fantastic. So I'm glad that we have this connection. So let's talk a little bit more now in a little more detail about your book. I wonder if maybe one way of getting started on the particulars of the book is if you would please lay out for the listeners, the folks who are enjoying our podcast, the story that you tell in the book, where you get started, what sorts of topics you pursue, and where you end up in the book, just sort of giving everyone an overview.
So it's a study of various ways that people engage with their ethnicity and engage with their ideas about citizenship and belonging in Buenos Aires. And so it's a focus on immigrant adults trying to navigate between their own interests of ethnicity, community, and belonging or identity and their connection to the place they came from or the place they live in. But also it has a strong focus on two other groups, which are not homogeneous groups, but Argentines who have opinions about immigration, quite often negative ones or concerns about immigration, and then the children of these immigrants. And the book tries to really put in the foreground either children's agency or children's ideas and children's power to influence community development or influence the idea or the sort of influence cultural pluralism, or how adults talked about children's agency or influence over these things. So it's often not children's voices, but still the focus on how adults are talking about children as central actors in this broader history of immigration, which is something that is not often done in lots of social histories of migration. And so it charts this history. It's a thematic approach in the book, focusing on three main themes of education, religion, and social welfare. Because in my view, in discovering this in the sources, it seemed to me that these are the central things that made up communities. So rather than clubs or singing societies or sports associations, or if there were a German football team or something like that, the things that really got the numbers of people, got the money, got the discussions in newspapers were these community institutions of education, religion, and social welfare, institutions such as hospitals or orphanages and work placement associations and things like that. And so it's focusing on these things that I would say are the most important features of a German community in Buenos Aires in the turn of the 20th century. And I would say also based on other newer research I'm doing, also the central features of most other ethnic communities in Buenos Aires in that time period, the things that really motivated people to get involved in community and the things that outside observers would see as the markers of community. And it looks then at how people over this 50-year period from 1880 to 1930 navigated between an interest in community, an interest in ethnicity, and an interest in Argentina. And one point I make is that even though they're doing very ethnic things, like trying to make sure that children speak German or trying to sort of preserve some sort of idea of a separate German community, if you look at what they're doing inside those institutions, there's lots about those institutions that are very Argentine. So even though it's not sort of a normative homogenized vision of what a Hispanic Argentine nation should be, in the vision of the people who are participating in these activities, they think they're still and they want to be doing something that's Argentine. So they're not, in their mind, not undermining their Argentine belonging by also encouraging children to speak German. And in fact, and this is an argument that other historians have made, particularly Jeffrey Lesser and Ranan Rain, that in those in Latin America, those in Argentina and Brazil in particular, who saw themselves as ethnic, they would often make this argument that the best way to be the best Argentines or the best Brazilians, since they happen to be ethnic, was to embrace that ethnic difference. And so if they hadn't been of German heritage and if they were something else, they should be pushing a different kind of dualism. But since they happen to be German, the best way to be the best possible Argentines was to embrace both that Germanness and that Argentineness at the same time. And rather than forgetting their European contribution to Argentine society, they should instead embrace it. So this is sort of looking at these ideas of this group of immigrants and their children embracing that sort of, I mean, academically you call it being examples of their hybridity, but they would often see it as embracing or fostering their duality. And they would be both 100% Argentine and 100% German at the same time. And so it's a study of how this evolves over time in this era of mass migration. Argentina, the the 50 years from 1880 to 1930 are these very transformative years in Argentine history, after which then things slow down quite a lot in the 1930s and 1940s. And it situates then German immigration in this broader context of Argentine migration history and Argentine migration historiography. And in so doing, as a side note, it also situates it within Argentine dates and Argentine periods and draws parallels to other groups in Argentina rather than situating it in German historiography in the sense of, you know, my end date's not 1933, my end date's 1930, because that's the end date that every other book about migration to Argentina is about, rather than obviously a key date in German history. So it's sort of thinking of how migration, which happens to be German, is related to a broader Argentine history of cultural pluralism and migration.
This is very interesting because you do a lot of very good work, I think, in the book on ethnicity and its plurality. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about I'm just going to quote from short quote that you from the introduction of your book where you describe ethnic categories as, and I think this is exactly right, as situational, overlapping, and contradictory. And indeed, what it means even to be German in your book is quite plural itself. I wonder if you could talk about that just a little bit.
I'm sorry, actually, the last 5 seconds of what you said cut out for me. As you said that its ethnic categories are situational, overlapping, or contradictory. And then I lost you for a second. And I think I'm not actually sure what your question was.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, that's okay. So you describe ethnic categories as situational, overlapping, and contradictory. And then I thought it was interesting that actually what it means to be German in the book table. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, about the situationalness, if you will, of Germanness in Argentina.
Right. So just to give you some sort of examples of this, which I found something I found quite interesting. So someone could be German, and what it means to be German is that they're Argentine citizens. They've never been to Germany, and they speak Spanish perhaps better than they speak German, or they speak them equally well, or they speak them more or less equally well overall, but they're better at talking about cinema, economics, and government in Spanish, and better at talking about food, love, and everyday life in German. So they're or equally good at some of those many ways of how language works. But they call themselves German, and people around them call them German. So that makes them German in many ways, but it doesn't necessarily make them German the same way that someone who has never left Berlin, German. They both think of themselves and are identified by others as German, but it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing to be German in Argentina as it does to be German in Germany, let alone what it would mean to be German in, say, Canada, the United States. And at the same time, that person, though, perhaps one example, there's this female protagonist, one of the few female leaders of some of the institutions I study. She was the president of, for some years, the German women's home in Buenos Aires, which was interested in migrant women and sort of creating a sort of idea of a German respectability by helping working class German women behave in certain ways and not behave in other ways. And at the same time, she was Argentine born and studied actually in Switzerland, but her father was a German immigrant. So at the same time, though, she was the president of the Argentine National Association against White Slavery. So that's an early 20th century movement against sort of perceptions of female prostitution and migration and female prostitution. And so many times in her life, this woman was not at all German. She was an Argentine feminist. She's in Argentine history. She can be talked about as an early Argentine feminist with a distinct European background than some people, but there was lots of people with distinct European backgrounds. In many ways, I think when people spoke to her, they didn't think of her as a non-native speaker of Spanish. So this woman, many times, took on a non-German or non-ethnic identity and just behaved as an Argentine feminist in the early 20th century. But then at other times, she goes to an ethnic association where she's also in different years a leader of that association and a financial contributor for a longer period of time, and is very interested in the Germanness of her institution, interested in fostering a certain idea of a German community and engaging for hours of the day with German speaking peoples and German speaking migrants in Argentina. So at different times, she's putting on different hats. So that's something that's situational about her ethnicity, and in many ways her German ethnicity played, I would say, a very small role at some of the time when she was engaged in these broader Argentine political debates. But other times, her Germanness was a central factor of why she participated in German language institutions in the city. And you have other examples of this, of children when they're at a German school, their Germanness is sort of, you know, like a lot of other kids at the school. They have one or two German parents, and they have some sort of German Argentine identity. But then when they get their first job, or then they go to an Argentine university, because that's what the majority of kids who went to German schools did, they go to an Argentine university, they might downplay their ethnic difference. And so in a sense, there's a situational ethnicity, that their ethnicity at university when they're 20 years old, or when they're in a relationship when they're 25 years old, is that, you know, no, they're Argentine, they're Spanish speakers, but even though they have these other things that they can do at other times, they're not doing those, they're not claiming those are part of their identity or their everyday experience at other times in their lives.
It's really interesting. You looked at I wonder if you can, you said a few minutes ago, or you've been speaking here and there about the various social institutions, or maybe we could even say social practices through which a pluralist Argentina was created. I wonder if you can talk a little bit more, in a little bit more detail, about what these institutions were. I mean, you've mentioned some of them, institutions of social welfare, for example, and schools. But I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about, and I was very interested, by the way, when you described very briefly at the beginning of your comments, you described very briefly why you thought it was important to have chosen these particular kinds of institutions. But I wonder if you can speak a little bit more about both of those things, both the plurality of institutions that you chose to examine and why you chose those.
Right. And I think part of your question is about Buenos Aires more broadly in this time period. And so it's a city that grows from 169,000 people in 1869 to 1.2 million in 1910. And by 1936, it has about 2.4 million people. So it goes from a town, a very peripheral part of Spanish America in many ways, to the second largest city on the Atlantic coast of the Americas after New York. It's a city massively transformed largely by immigration. There's also internal migration and internal demographic change, but immigration, almost all of which comes from Europe, although there are important, there is also other immigration from East and South Asia and the Ottoman Empire, which depending on the time period in Argentine history, that is or is not called European immigration. And so there's, all told, there's about the population of the country in 1869 is 2 million people, and then 6 million immigrants arrive, and the population of the country in 1914 is 8 million people. Not all those immigrants are what make that population change, but because some go back, but there's a massive influx of immigrants. In the city of Buenos Aires in 1914, 50% of the people who live in the city were born somewhere else. So 50% of people in the city are immigrants. And what's not usually talked about in that very often used statistic in Argentine history is that if you pay attention to the children of those immigrants, who also are engaging in sort of naturally part of a culturally plural society because their parents are immigrants, that number is more like 70% of people in the city have something, a very easy access to ethnicity. They're either they're immigrants themselves, or they're living with someone who is an immigrant, or they were raised by someone who's an immigrant. So this is a city, to use a modern term, this is a multicultural city, one of the most multicultural cities you'll ever find. At the same time, you have this nascent state apparatus that it's a wealthy state, it's a wealthy society. The state's this liberal state, there's liberal reformers trying to get a hold of the massive development and the massive immigration as one concern that they have, how the nation is being transformed by immigration. They're creating institutions to sort of develop, to make their society, you could say. And one big thing is through universal public education, and also things though, like creating hospitals or building streetcars or building public or improving networks of public water or sewage and things like that. So there's a sort of transforming society. And within that transforming society and the creation of all these new institutions for the booming metropolis are these institutions that are run by immigrants. And on one hand, they're being run by immigrants because immigrants, I think, see institutions as a way to create communities, and they think it's sort of they're doing their part in a society that they want to be culturally plural. And so the way that you make it culturally plural is you carve out a place for ethnic communities in this broader society. And since things are changing so quickly, the Argentine state in many ways is happy to let this happen. So they have bigger fish to fry than to say, no, we're going to be the only institution that plays a role in creating hospitals or public health. And so this Argentine state is allowing space for other actors along with those other interest groups as well. The Catholic Church, private philanthropy is also playing a role in this society. But because it's undergoing such massive transformation, I think it's one of the reasons why immigrants are able to carve out a space for themselves. And these are many groups that are doing this. And Germans, if you look at what German immigrants are doing, and then you look at what Italian immigrants are doing or what Syrian immigrants are doing, they're all doing very similar things. And so this seems to tell you something not only about what German ethnicity or German identity, but it tells you something about how immigrants and the broader society are interacting. And so as I mentioned, there are these, I would say, core institutions of community and core institutions that sort of are the ones that also are engaging with the broader society in a sense, like making schools or making a hospital or making a German or a British cemetery or a work placement agency for German immigrants or a work placement agency for Italian immigrants, or making a mutual aid society, which is a bit like an insurance, a sort of nonprofit insurance association, for health insurance association. This is something that Italians and Spaniards and Catalans and Basques and French and British and Germans and Ukrainians and Jews, that all sorts of groups are doing, and this creates a culturally plural society. If you just walk down the street, you'll see institutions with names that are marking this cultural pluralism, and then it's that are sort of representatives of a community behind those kinds of institutions. This place, I would say, it has a transformative impact on Buenos Aires society from the time that this really erupts in the 1880s. And then it starts to take a different form in the mid-20th century, from the 1930s to the 1960s, in that state institutions become more important in terms of, say, membership numbers, how many people are involved in either state or ethnic institutions, that the balance between the two starts to shift towards the state and away from ethnicity. But these things still exist today with far fewer members. Some have gone up, some have closed, or others have transformed in the same way that a society that after waves of immigration transforms. So say there are fewer German schools today in Buenos Aires than there were 80 years ago, and those German schools are serving very few children of German-speaking immigrants. They are serving some people with some sort of German identity, that have a German-speaking grandparent or maybe even great-grandparent, or serving Argentines who think that having access to German language education, to some sort of level of bilingualism, is an important thing. And then the same thing you could say about an Italian school or a French school in Buenos Aires as well, that they've sort of gone with the times. Some of them have gone with the times and transformed to serve different kinds of people and different kinds of interests in society, and others have closed or greatly reduced their numbers or the impact that they have on broader groups of people.
Yeah, that's very fascinating. And you laid that out really beautifully. I wonder if, actually, it's funny that you said cemeteries, because I have a particular interest in cemeteries, and I was actually looking around on the internet just to see if why it was during the time that I was reading your book. Actually, I started thinking about other kinds of cultural institutions that people set up when they immigrate to other places. And one of the places, of course, that occurred to me was cemeteries. And so it was interesting that you said that. And I also, my grandparents, my father's parents, ended up immigrating again after they lived in Argentina for a long time. They ended up living the rest of their lives in Quito, in Ecuador. And I recently had the experience of going to visit my grandparents, who were Hungarians, graves in the Cementerio Alemán. So, which looked beautifully and amazingly like almost any German cemetery I've ever seen in Germany.
Yeah, so we spontaneously discovered during live recording that we've both been to the same school, one as a student and one as a student teacher in Schleswig-Holstein. And I actually already knew you had an academic interest in cemeteries, and this is actually something I've never published on, but something that I think is also centrally interesting and important, and actually a very innovative way to understand ethnicity in whether it's Buenos Aires or more broadly in Latin America. So I've also been to a German cemetery in Sao Paulo. The central argument in my book is that people organized community and people cared about ethnicity because they were thinking about the future. And so in studies of migration, there's a tendency to talk about the past. So immigrants themselves are talking about the past. They talk about their homeland, where they came from. We really care, migration historians really care about the place someone was born, because that's how we're sort of putting them into categories, that whatever their nationality is in terms of what passport they carry, that might be one thing, but the nationality of their birth, so therefore their past, is what seems to be our category of analysis. But when the things that garner so much community attention and newspapers, so much money, so much membership, their active involvement in an institution is, say, a school, and then in that school they talk about making sure we give them their German cultural heritage, access to their German cultural heritage, and a proper upbringing as Argentine citizens where they will spend their future. This suggests to me that people are at least as interested in their future as in their past. And to take that one step further, the final future that one has is, in many ways, you could say, a cemetery. And it's kind of maybe a dark kind of history to write. And so I'm not sure if I'm going to write an article on ethnic death, but there's a lot of ethnic death taking place in Buenos Aires. So there's a German cemetery. The history of that, there was, in this context of 19th century Buenos Aires, there was a dissident cemetery. So that's a cemetery for Protestants. And then because of urban development, the city decides to make the Protestants, they need a new cemetery. So right around 1910, the dissident cemetery is being moved to this brand new cemetery area on the edge of the city, right as World War I breaks out. So what was going to be the brand new Protestant cemetery of Buenos Aires becomes a separate, divided by a wall, a British cemetery and a German cemetery, and closely connected to, in the case of the German cemetery, the city's Lutheran church. And in fact, the Lutheran church has some of its institutions actually in that, at the door of the gate of that cemetery. But yeah, you go into the cemetery and very many things about it feel like a cemetery in Germany. There are some things that I think make it different. One is, I mean, some of the gravestones are written in Spanish. There are definitely Jewish tombstones in this German cemetery. There are also the German language Jewish tombstones in the British cemetery just across the wall. So Argentina had a very large German Jewish migration, particularly in the 1930s. It's the third biggest destination for German Jewish refugees after the United States and Palestine. So Argentina, there's about 30,000 or 40,000 German Jews who go, specifically just in the 1930s, to Buenos Aires. And some of those people are buried not in the German cemetery, but in the neighboring British cemetery. And I'm sure they're also buried elsewhere. But you can take this further in addition to just German, specifically German and British cemetery, in the broader Catholic cemetery that surrounds the German and British cemeteries. All these mutual aid societies, which I mentioned earlier, which are in fact part of a new project I'm working on. All of these mutual aid societies, which are fundamentally organized or oriented or focused on providing healthcare services. The other big service that members got was burial in the mausoleum of the mutual aid society. So there is a Catalan, a Spanish, an Italian mausoleum, very impressive buildings that are burial grounds on ethnic lines for the members of these associations. So people are organizing up until their final moment along ethnic lines. Some people, not all people, of course, other people could care less about their ethnic backgrounds, but a lot of people are organizing on ethnic lines. And I think it's another way to think about how a culturally plural, markers of a culturally plural society and how a culturally plural society is organized in the case of organizing burial practices. And this gets at questions of religion as well, and in terms of religious diversity and religious intolerance as well, and sort of how religion is being playing a role in creating separate cemeteries or not creating separate cemeteries. And so anyway, that's another interest of mine, although I haven't written on it yet, and I'm not sure what I will do with what I've just explained. But now I've published it in podcast form, so maybe that can be the end of my thinking on ethnic death.
Maybe, but I think you should do more, because I think it's a really interesting subject, and I think that there's beyond the sort of community and sort of ethnic issues, there are also aesthetic matters that are very fascinating. And of course, those are ethnic too in certain ways. I mean, the fact that I said that the German cemetery in Quito, Ecuador looks very, very much, except for the flora, looks very, very much like a German cemetery is very interesting. So, you know, of course, it's a particular interest of mine. And I certainly, I don't want to get in the business of of telling other people what they should spend their time researching and writing about, but I, for one, would find it very interesting.
Well, I think you're onto something. I mean, you've already been onto something. I know you've done great work on this topic, and I think maybe I should be inspired by you. And you're very right. The space of these the way ethnicity and cemeteries are laid out. There is a certain a German cemetery has a bit more of a feel of Central Europe and not of Argentina in many ways. There's some things about it that are the calmness, even if the flora is different in terms of the specific trees, the nature, the way nature is used in a cemetery, in this case of the German cemetery and the British cemetery, is distinctly British and German and not Hispanic Argentine in many ways. So there's an element of how that greenery is playing a role in creating a bit of an ethnic difference or a cultural persistence or cultural pluralism in the layout of, in the groundskeeping of the space.
I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. Very, very, very interesting stuff. So could you talk a little bit more about, well, actually, this is something I wanted to ask. As a historian of migration, do you, and having written the book now, do you, and having been yourself a person who's moved around quite a lot, and having come yourself from, you know, being a citizen of a country which has historically been and continues to be a very richly, abundantly immigrant society, do you feel that Argentina differs from other countries in terms of the broader history of immigration? Are there certain particularities about the ways that people immigrated to Argentina and the experiences that they had there that are different, say, from people who immigrated to Canada or somewhere else? Is there some special quality about the immigrant society that was created?
Definitely some local variation. I think there's a lot of, you can make an argument about commonalities of cultures of cultural pluralism or countries of cultural pluralism across the Americas. The dissertation from which this book came was actually a comparison of these topics of education and religion in Buenos Aires and Ontario. So in fact, what was my MA thesis interest continued to be my dissertation interest. And then in revising the book, this might be a topic for another follow-up question, but the dissertation and this book are actually quite different. So the book has more chapters, and then within the chapters, the book has 50% of the chapters, so four out of the six chapters of the book were in my dissertation, but two were not, and there was a lot of new research in the chapters that did come from the dissertation, and they compared Canada and Argentina. One idea I had when I was thinking of keeping the comparative nature of the dissertation and have a book about it, I was thinking of calling the book Regimes of Pluralism and thinking about the commonalities and the differences between two systems of how cultural pluralism develops in two different parts of the Americas. And then you could, of course, take that. I could have Regimes of Pluralism. This could be 16 different places in the Americas or around the globe of how cultural pluralism is something very universal and something also very distinct. So one thing that specifics of how Argentina, I think, is culturally different, the regime of pluralism, to use that idea that I had for a while and then have since booted, but now I'm publishing it in podcast form. It's great. I should go on podcasting more often. There's just some basic facts of how the state interacted with immigrant communities. So the state allowed far more space in Argentina than it did in the United States and Canada for immigrant communities to do things. And that then really affected how a community developed and how a society became culturally plural and how it stayed culturally plural in different ways. So a very simple example is that in Canada and the United States, in areas where there was lots of immigrants of a single background, those immigrants could get themselves elected to local school boards, and local school boards up until around 1900, 1910 could teach that dominant other language other than English, so say German or Polish or wherever the region was that had a lot of immigrants from one place, could teach those foreign languages in public schools and in a way, way more than just as a second language. It could be actually a somewhat bilingual school in Chicago or in rural Ohio. You could have these semi-German schools within the public system. And at the same time, you could not have private schools that just on their own accord had some state regulation that wrote final exams for the exit exam of grade of elementary school, but totally outside the state system. So immigrants in North America were, in the case of education, had to be brought in into the public system. And then within that public system, other languages than English were allowed some space to encourage the children, or to teach the children of immigrants in certain ways, foster bilingualism. So you say there was sort of state sanctioned bilingualism in public schools across North America up until the First World War, at least. In Argentina, no language other than Spanish was ever allowed to be taught in public schools. So it's actually a harsh system of stamping out cultural pluralism. And at the same time, the Argentine state was very happy to allow immigrant-run private schools to teach actually way more foreign language content and foreign country content, like more information about a foreign place, as long as they also abided by in growing amounts of state regulation, but that never amounted to more than about 30% of the curriculum up until at least 1930. So it's so the way the state is interacting, educational policies are interacting with an immigrant community is, in a sense, you could say, creating a different kind of cultural plural society, because one society is encouraged one way in Argentina, they're encouraging organization along ethnic lines. And if people, those who wanted to organize along ethnic lines and pay for private education for their children, can successfully foster cultural pluralism quite effectively because they have a lot of control over that private school system. In the case of North America, it's whatever cultural pluralism that is going to be fostered through education is going to be done much more under state control. And so as a result, any German school, German language education that took place in Ohio in 1890 was way less than you'd find in Buenos Aires in 1890 or 1920 because of the nature of state regulation, state funding, and ideologies of citizenship and language policies and things like that. And another thing, and this is one thing that I thought about as a citizen of Canada, citizen of what today we call a multicultural society. It wasn't a word that was used in English or in Spanish 100 years ago. So the academic term that's commonly used is cultural pluralism. The way multiculturalism or cultural pluralism was thought about 100 years ago in Buenos Aires is a little bit different than in the United States or Canada at the same time. So the reason the Argentines, there's a bit more of a binary of either or, either you're Argentine or you're German. This would be a common way that cultural pluralism was thought about in Buenos Aires in 1910. And so since you're German and not Argentine, then you're sort of given a bit more space to do German things. You're even though this child is an Argentine citizen, if somehow they have not been fully assimilated and part of the Argentine sort of homogeneous vision of nation that these government elites wanted, there was a bit more allowance for them to be then part of a German community. And this sort of either or binary of assimilated or European foreigner created a different kind of ethnic landscape in the city in a way that in North America, similar categories could be used about, either be American or don't be American, or, you need to become American and you're not American if you're not doing certain things. The way it was talked about and thought about in Argentina, I think, was a bit more binary than you'd find in Anglo-North America. And as a result, that created a different kind of cultural plural society.
You explained earlier the time frame of your book, which again, just to repeat for listeners, is the 1880s to the 1930s. One thing I wondered, and of course your explanation for that was a very good one. That your explanation was, just to repeat again, that you're using a time frame that makes sense within Argentine history. The only thing I wondered about. And maybe you can just say a little bit about this if it strikes your fancy, because there was such an enormous influx of immigrants into Argentina, again in the 40s. What would the story be different if you had extended the book by another chapter? And if so, how would it have been different? Or what other sorts of themes might have been pursued at that point?
Yeah, that's an interesting question on the two ways, because the history of immigration and migration to and from Argentina from, say, 1930 to 1960, you could say, took on a different tone. And at the same time, the history of German language, German-speaking migration in that time period was different. And but both of those, I would sort of again be striking a balance between is this a story of German migration or a story of migration and German as my German speakers as my case study. So a very quick overview. So between 1880 and 1930, there are about 100,000 German speakers that come to Argentina. They are from the German Empire, but also from four other places. So there's some Swiss, there's some Austro-Hungarian imperial citizens, and there are a lot of Russian citizens from the Russian Empire as well, particularly in the case of Argentina, from the Volga region of Russia. So these sort of four passports that people could have when they arrived in Argentina before 1918 or before 1914. And so I use this term German speakers. It's in many ways, there's a strong focus on German citizens. German citizens are often the ones that are leading sort of German community institutions, but it's an ambiguous category of who's being involved in these institutions. And it's by no means only a German citizen history. And German speakers themselves often use the term German speakers, or they often use the term Germans and German speakers. They often talk about serving both Germans and German speakers at the same time, and that was their goal. And in this doing, I think that's an example of how they had an ethno-linguistic understanding of themselves and how that would fit into Argentine citizenship or Argentine belonging. And that's part of the play I have there with Argentine citizenship and being German in some way. So there's 100,000 who come between 1880 and 1930. And then in the 1940s, there are about particularly 1933 to 1945, or and really 1941 or 1942, there are approximately 50,000 German speakers from Germany and Austria, sort of Nazi Germany, depending on the time, who come to Argentina, and about 30,000 of those 40 to 50,000 are German Jews. So there's another, say, 50. So there's 100,000 up until 1930. There's about 50,000 in the Nazi period, and then from 45 to 55, there's another 40,000 German-speaking migrants. Again, those displaced persons from Central and Eastern Europe are also a significant part of those 40,000. So a broader history would include these. I mean, more people, transformations in migratory waves. There would be these two extra topics that would definitely come up in a book about the later periods. One would be German Jewish refugees, and there's a historiography on this of conflicts between various groups of people. So Buenos Aires is a city in the 1930s and 1940s that in many ways Nazi sympathies are exhibited. But it's also one of the biggest sites of Nazi resistance in the Americas or in the world at the same time. So there are these two big newspapers. One doesn't seem to have any, or it's a big supporter, a nationalist newspaper, a big supporter of the Nazi regime. And then there's one that's adamantly opposed and denouncing the Nazi regime through the 1930s and 1940s. So there's a history there of these sort of competing Germanies. And there's a great book coming out soon and a recent dissertation on this topic of competing Germanies in Buenos Aires, and how there's these two worlds that came together or clashed or lived separate from each other in 1930s Buenos Aires. And then there'll be the 1945 to 55 period that you'd also look at, which includes both war criminals or people somehow involved in the Holocaust, but also a lot of displaced persons who had various relationships with the Holocaust and World War II. And of course, I think, or it seems to me that Argentina, when you say Germans in Argentina, when I told people I was running a dissertation about Germans in Argentina, everyone said, oh, Nazis. That was sort of the go-to thing about Germans in Argentina. And that would be definitely a wise thing to include as a subject of analysis if I was running a book that included up until about 1960. But it would also be something that I would broaden to focus on these other kinds of migration. At the same time, just to de-Germanize that story, if I did write another 30 years of history into this book or in a sequel, there's this time of massive transformation in Argentine society. In many ways, the book is more about ethnicity than it is about migration. So it's how ethnicity plays out once on the ground and how communities are developed and what Argentine citizens of in this case, German heritage, think about Germany and community and things like that. So one thing that really would change my story is, in addition to all that migration taking place that I've just described, would be peronism and populist politics in Argentina from 1946 to 1955. So again, would fall right into that period. In the 1940s and 1950s, the Argentine state massively expands. One area that really becomes involved in is social welfare institutions. So any interest that I have, that the book would have on social welfare institutions is a central part of community. These institutions are under attack, is the wrong word. Their significance in relation to other kinds of involvement in social welfare is greatly diminished as a result of a rising welfare state in Argentina after 1946. So involvement in mutual aid societies and work placement and things like that was transformed because of the rising influence of a state or a more activist state in playing a bigger role in society rather than a laissez-faire liberal state that defines the period that I'm studying of 1880 to 1930. So both of those things would make for, I think it would have to be more than just one or two more chapters because of the second Argentine elements of things that changed as well, in addition to the migration of German speakers. So it would make for a great second or third or two more books on the topic.
Yes, I think so too. Listening to you talk about that, I want to read about this. So I think maybe somewhere down the line, this is something that you might pursue, because I truly think it's fascinating. I wonder if on that note, we've taken up a lot of your time, and I really appreciate having these few minutes to talk to you, because the work that you've done is just absolutely fascinating. And actually listening to you talk about it is in some ways even better. There are things that it seems like came out in your conversation that were, that I don't remember reading about. So in other words, if people will now go out and read the book in a sort of conversation with the podcast, they'll get all sorts of even more interesting details than the ones that are in the book. I wonder if on that note, oh yeah, absolutely.
I was just going to say, the New Books in History podcast that I've listened to, of books that I've already read, I would agree with you. It's an amazing other medium that you can hear the author zooming in or elaborating on a point, or because, you know, the author spent 5 or 8 minutes talking about a single point of the book. It might have come out in reading, but it might have come out even better listening to it. And the two combined in dialogue with one another is quite an effective way to understand a book and understand an author's ideas, I think. So I think what you guys are doing with these podcasts is quite helpful for readers.
That's lovely. Thank you very much. And I hope people will take your advice, because I do think that, you know, for the listeners, and I'm sure many of them do what you and I do, which is you hear about a book, you listen to the podcast a bit, and then you go and read the book. And I think that really is the combination of the two things, really is a unique kind of experience of new scholarship. I wonder if on this note, though, if we could ask you about new projects, because of course, between the two of us, we've given you several ideas for new projects, some of which you had already thought of yourself, maybe some new ones that came into the frame through our conversation. But I know that you're already working on lots of different things. So maybe you could about some of what you're working on.
Yeah. I think it's a dangerous question to ask an academic what he or she is working on now, because you can, of course, you'll get the multiple projects answer, which will, you know, occupy as much time as this entire podcast up until now. The main thing I'm working on, and that I, you know, that I've got, that what will be the thing that would have money to hire graduate students for, the thing that my university and the Canadian government are paying money for, is a project on health and migration in Buenos Aires. So in the book, it grows out of a small interest in the book, which was on this thing called the German Hospital. So this major German language institution in Buenos Aires played a central role in the German community of Buenos Aires, and it got a lot of money and treated a lot of patients and had a lot of interesting things about class dynamics between the wealthy who were donating money and then their goal being serving working class German-speaking immigrants. But I'm working on a book, though, and the other thing that came out from that first project was this interest in engaging with broader trends in the historiography of not doing a case study of a single group for just so we can learn more about a single group, which is a great thing, but it's also very important to connect that single group's history to the broader landscape of what's going on in the society. So you can learn more about Argentina or more about immigration when learning about German speakers in Argentina. And with that in mind, so the project I'm working on now is on every immigrant group in the city of Buenos Aires that played a role that played a role in healthcare services, and whether it's the circulation of medical knowledge or paying for healthcare or providing healthcare services along ethnic lines in the similar time period, in my case now from 1880s to 1955, which then includes this transformative period of Peronism and populism and in mid-20th century Argentina. So it's, and the thing about the striking about Buenos Aires still today is that there's hospitals all over the city, in addition to, you know, a state hospital named after such and such a politician or a Catholic hospital named after such and such a thing. There are a bunch of hospitals with names like the British Hospital, the French Hospital, the Spanish Hospital, the Galician Center, which is a hospital, the Italian Hospital, the German Hospital, the Syrian Lebanese Hospital, the Jewish Hospital. And in many ways, I mean, you see this in today you see this in North American cities with Jewish hospitals. And in the past, there were things like there was German hospitals in New York City and in Philadelphia. There was a Swedish hospital in Chicago. So the idea, though, of organizing healthcare services along ethnic lines is something that is, you could say, common across the Americas, but very pronounced in Buenos Aires. So that immigrants played a fundamental role in healthcare services. In fact, in 1910, the five hospitals that existed, the ethnic hospitals that existed at that time, treated 20% of all the patients in the city. So these are, if you look at them together, rather than as a history of German immigrants or history of a German hospital or of a British hospital in the city, look at history of various migrant groups and healthcare. It's sort of a way of understanding a broader social history of healthcare and medicine in Argentine or Buenos Aires society. So it's looking at various groups of immigrants and how they organized a lot of ethnic activities and community activities to provide healthcare services. And in so doing, carved out a certain space for ethnicity and cultural pluralism alongside the state, the Catholic Church, and Spanish-speaking philanthropists. So that's, broadly speaking, what I'm working on.
Sounds amazing. I won't bore people by telling our audience yet another thing that you and I now have in common. I won't do that. But what I will say is this: I have had the enormous pleasure this afternoon of speaking with Benjamin Bryce. Benjamin Bryce is assistant professor of history at the University of Northern British Columbia, and he has written a wonderful book, To Belong in Buenos Aires, Germans, Argentines, and the Rise of a Pluralist Society. It was published just this year, 2018, with Stanford University Press. And I urge all of you, particularly those of you who have interests in the history of Latin America, the history of cultural pluralism, multiculturalism, the history of migration broadly, and the history of Germany, all of you, I think you will find something very fascinating about this book. Ben Bryce, it has really been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, and to the listeners for listening to our conversation.
It's great. Thanks, Ben. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.